Okay, so this is episode 2 of On Irish Road, and I am going to change it up just a little bit. I listened to the last one and I thought, that's just not really me. I'm a little angrier than that, and I like to think I'm a little bit more colorful than that. So, you know, I guess this is about a couple of things. Really, it's justice for the family. For myself, my siblings, and the truth. I don't want this to happen to anybody else. And I think if we can get to the bottom of what happened that night, then we can at least say we did what we could and at least answer some of the questions that we have about who they are and maybe never exactly what happened that night. But, and the like I said, the year plus leading up to it and the months after it, it's been 2 months since my father passed away, and it has been 2 months of absolute anguish and rage and reflection and crying and just trying to get back to some sort of normal is the stupid word. Peace, I think, is probably what we're looking for the most, like some peace. And mad at myself for not questioning and having conversations with my father that may have prevented some of this from happening. I think really realistically, likely not, because my dad was a narcissist and pretty high on that spectrum for sure. And we'll go into all those things, right? The reason I know that and how I know it and the things he did and said, and some of that will come out tonight, but it's a long road, and I just want to be honest about it and about my feelings about it. I'm really mad, and I'm really, really confused about my own emotions regarding my dad and why he would leave his children with such a mess to clean up. You know, I think it's mostly because of his personality disorder and him wanting to paint a certain narrative. You need new sources, fresh meat, if you will, for that, right? You're around a narcissist for long enough, you start to go, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, or you know, they divide the worlds. They make sure that their worlds don't collide. What he maybe told my brother, he didn't tell me, or I had a completely different version of it. He played all sides against each other and put himself in the middle. He was the great orchestrator of the drama, and it was all about control. He actually wrote me a letter before I got married. It was nasty. I mean, just a nasty letter. But it started out by saying, and I'll never forget this, these are the memories you're left with when you have a narcissist as a father. There's only one ship and I'm the captain. And I think that kind of sums up his view on the world, right? It was Ken's world. And if he needed you, he'd play you. And if he didn't, then you could just sit there and shut up. And we are dealing with our trauma and trying to forge new relationships, my siblings and I. And because we were played against each other. He never liked the idea of us talking. You know, I didn't want what he told Aaron or Mike for me to know, because it would be different than, right? And because he was talking crap, really, on all three of us, not just to us, but to probably everyone that would listen. He was a victim. His kids didn't love him. Why? I don't understand why. Well, it could be, you know, that you beat my younger brother to a pulp. Could be more than once, by the way. Could be that you were abusive in many ways to all of us. Hot chocolate thrown on me, hot soup. Really, his favorite with me was throwing foods. And then abuse by comparison, comparing people. So ultimately, my dad had a big part in this. And so, you know, really trying to figure out, do you, because of that, you know, and I even think I said one time, he's going to find himself in the hands of bad people, because he's running away from the good ones, the people who really loved him in spite of the horrors. And I would say many times, I'm going to mourn what never was. You know, the end of all hope of having that dad that loves you and cares about you. And enough of that. There'll be plenty of that. There's so much of that. So I'm going to take you to that night. I'm not going to go too far back before it, just a few days. And I'm going to take you through the evening. And then we will get into all the things that happened after and all the things that happened before. And is there a there? And I think, yeah, there is. So 2 months since my dad died, today we hired a private investigator. And the office manager for this private investigator said to me, after, bless her heart, listening to me forever, and that's a nice bless her heart, not like the crappy bless her heart. She was incredibly kind and very sweet. You should write a book is what she said. She's like, and I'm the office manager for a private investigator, so I've heard a lot, but you should write a book. And so I guess this is kind of my book. Maybe there is a book in me, I don't know, but this is just me being able to get it out there into the universe. So if you're listening, thank you for that, because I think I've worn everybody else out, and this is just a way for me to organize my thoughts and feelings and have it out there. So April, this past April, 2021, last time I talked to my dad was on April the 7th. He had texted me a few times and told me that, you know, he was going on hospice and that he wasn't returning to his home. And just so you know how it worked, Julie, the caretaker, and her husband, Kevin, who was apparently the power of attorney and is now the executor. We'll get into how they met later. And because that's very interesting. And I had not heard this from Julie. So my dad texted me and said, I'm not going back to my place. I'm staying here. He was just supposed to be on a 2-week trip there. And then he would go home and he'd stay there for 2 or 3 weeks. And then, you know, they might come and check in on him or whatever. But he said they deemed that he couldn't return home. That they, you know, and by they, I mean them, Julie and Kevin. And that, you know, Julie had decided to bring in hospice. And so, and he said on the phone, but hospice needs help. That's what Julie keeps telling me. My dad sounded very normal to me, just like he had for the past year, like an occasional cough. He had idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a terminal lung disease, that just slowly, you can't breathe, right? You're losing oxygen. So he was hooked up to oxygen. When we were there in December of 2020 for Christmas, the tubes were everywhere. And we had visited with him at Julie and Kevin's home in New Bloomfield on 9 Irish Road. And I'll talk about that later. So she had my number, my phone number. She's the caretaker. You would assume the caretaker would be contacting you about what's going on with your father. That never happened. So until a few days before, and only because pressure was put on them at that point. So my dad's telling me this, and, you know, and he calls Julie down and, to talk about a trip that my husband and I were taking to Napa with some friends for our anniversary. And, oh, you know, Julie knows all about Napa. So, you know, Julie, come down here. And so she came down into his basement bedroom and with no windows. Anyway, and so she comes downstairs and she says, so do you have any questions? about that same tone. And I said about, she said hospice in that tone. At that moment, I think, you know, you could feel the contention. You could feel that this was, you know, when you think friend or foe, at that moment I was like foe for sure. And so I said, yeah, like what's going on? She's like, oh, you know, nope, your dad is, he's comfortable and hospice just brings in, you know, people to help and it's just help. It doesn't, it's not imminent. This is on April the 7th. Not imminent. You know, it's, and I said, do I need to come out? And she said, oh, no. I'll let you know when you need to come out. And I was like, okay. I mean, right? I'm a little concerned, but again, you have a fractured relationship with your father. You have been in contact with him, I mean, for years at this point, but it was strained on my end. My dad would tell you we had a wonderful relationship. Well, he told me that. I don't know what he told other people. Of course, I didn't think so. I thought, well, I mean, we talk, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have a good relationship. It just means we don't have a terrible one. Relationship was a stretch in general, and there was always love there, but where there's love, there's often pain and hurt, and especially when you're the child of a narcissist and somebody really high on that spectrum, for sure. And some people might be questioning why I call him that. And I think by the end of this, you'll know, you know, that's also coming from therapists and, you know, research and on our part to try to heal ourselves from so many years of so much pain. And I was like, okay, all right. I mean, great that you'll let me know. My dad and I continued to text, and my father was very particular about when you would call him. So you didn't just call my dad out of the blue. Like if you did, you were likely not, he was not going to pick up. And he would text you and say, I'll talk to you on, you know, Thursday at 2:38 PM my time or something ridiculous like that. Right. I mean, you get like these very, you know, rigid responses. He controlled when we were going to talk. There's a little, you know, one of those symptoms of, you know, a narcissist is they control everything and, they need to prepare. So spontaneity is not necessarily something that they do unless it's, you know, spontaneously abusing you. And, so that was that conversation. And that was, you know, of course I didn't know it at the time, but the last time I talked to my dad, and then on April the 20th, we texted in between. He said, we'll call you soon in a text on April the 20th. And I love you, Dad. And that never happened, I think, for a couple of reasons, or really one, I guess. Major reason is because I think at that point they had some real control over him. I think they had control over the timeline. And, you know, there were other people that were concerned at this point. My uncles, one of them in particular, and his wife. And they wanted to come see my dad. Around this time when I hadn't heard from my dad for 3 days. And my brother had tried calling. My brother reached out to me. And we were talking at the time. My sister and I had seen each other at Christmas. But that was a strained relationship. It's getting better. For sure. She's a good person. They both are. And so I texted both of them and I said, you know, Dad's on hospice and, you know, they said, don't come out. But so my brother tried calling a couple of times, texting as well. My sister was in a lot of pain from the abuse she suffered, and hers is a special kind of abuse. I think my brother and sister had just a whole different level of abuse that I didn't experience because I was the oldest, because I did get away from him earlier on. I think I had his number a little earlier than they did, and I had a support system in place that was very supportive. And but my sister was geographically very close to him, and he's the reason she came to Pennsylvania. She moved from Hot Springs with her husband and kids to Pennsylvania. And there's an interesting story there. I guess sidebar, we'll just really quick go into it. My dad worked for my uncle. Uncle owned a company, and it was a successful company. They were doing very well. It's my dad left his family to go out there in Kansas City and hightailed it out of town, became, you know, I mentioned it in my letter, Ken the Bachelor, you know, Ken the avid investor, and just dropped us like, you know, a hot pan. He just was done. And so at one point he decides he wants Erin up there, and Erin is the youngest, and I hope she doesn't not like me saying this, but she's a bit of a people pleaser. She's definitely the most outgoing out of the three of us. She has a bevy of friends. I could only dream about having that many friends. She's an extrovert. She's, you know, the life of the party. She's fun. She's also the one that was probably more doting on my dad, because she, I think, was kind of easily manipulated because she wanted it to work and she tried so hard. And so he is on a trip down there and says, hey, why don't you come back out here? You know, I'll pay for, you know, all this stuff. Like, you just come out and, you know, you can work for, you know, his brother's company, to Tim, my sister's husband. And they're like, yes, let's get out of Arkansas, right? Let's get out of Hot Springs. They just weren't doing well there. And this was a fresh start for them. And so my, you know, it's time to move. And, you know, my dad says, don't bring anything with you. Just leave it behind and come out here and we'll buy you all new furniture. Right? So they go out there and they think it's going to be great. And they leave all their stuff behind. And because my dad insisted, they get out there and they go to this furniture store. And my dad's like, pick out whatever you want. Right? They're like, okay, great. And so they pick out, you know, furniture for a house or a townhome. And so I'm not quite sure how Tim found out and Erin found out, but that they had to pay that back. That came out of Tim's paycheck from the company, with interest, by the way. So that's fun. With interest to his own daughter and son-in-law. And of course, they had stuff they could have brought with them and not owed this money and been indebted to my dad. And I remember Tim telling me, actually, I do remember how they found out. They were sitting at Tim and Erin's house and they were having a discussion and my dad brought it up. Well, so when do you want me to start taking that money out of your check? And Tim said, wait, what? What are you talking about? And he said, you know, for the furniture. He's like, you didn't think that was free, did you? And Tim said, well, yeah, I thought you were paying for it. We left all of our stuff behind. And they said, my dad just let out this like laugh, right? I can hear it. This kind of condescending, you fool, you know, you're so stupid. How could you think that? Laugh. Like, oh my God, like, come on. And so that money was withdrawn from Tim's paycheck. You know, and his paychecks were small and they're just trying to get settled into this new place. And Erin's trying to find a job and they have two kids and there's expenses with moving, deposits to be paid on utilities and deposit to be paid on their townhome. And, you know, a lot of expenses. And, so all of a sudden this like warm welcome they think they're getting turns really cold. And my, dad made it even more difficult at Christmas when Tim didn't have enough money to buy presents for the kids. He went to my uncle who owned the company and said, hey, you know, could you advance me some money? I can't afford to buy gifts for my kids. And my uncle said, well, no, I'm not getting in between, you know, you and Ken, my dad. And so he went to my dad and said, hey, you know, can you loan me some money? I need to get presents for the kids. And my dad said no. He said no. He did things like that often. So that relationship turned kind of right there, but it got worse. He would insert himself at Christmas and Thanksgiving. He'd sit there. He wanted to be waited on. So he wasn't helping. He wasn't playing with the kids. you know, he's making snide comments, judging the food, the house, the furniture. And every time he'd go in, they'd say, oh, he'd be like, how's that couch treating you? Like he bought it, which of course he didn't. And it's a couch. Like, who cares? It's a freaking couch, right? So that's an interesting little tidbit there. But back to what was going on. So my sister was not talking to my dad. She'd seen him at Christmas, and I think once after we left from Christmas, and I kind of brought her back into the fold, and I feel terrible about that because, you know, there are things I learned on that trip I didn't know about. And it was the beginning of Aaron and I think healing, really, and seeing each other and kind of, you know, bonding and getting to know one another, where my dad had really divided us earlier on. He loved it that way. And so, you know, I reached out to both of them and let them know, you know, I'm concerned. I can't get a hold of him. You know, have you talked to him? And at this point, I'm not wanting to call Julie, because that conversation, I just knew regardless, I was not going to get the response I needed. So we reached out to my uncle, not the one who owned the company, but the other one. And he was going to go see my dad. So they scheduled an appointment. This is probably right around like the 24th, 25th of April. And remember, the last text I ever received from my dad was on April the 20th. So he, you know, is going to go up there with his wife and then my cousin, the son of the other uncle. So not his son, but his nephew, to go see my dad. And my uncle knew these people. He knew some things we didn't know he knew at this point. And both of my uncles were talking at this point and had concerns. There were some big concerns. And because we're not a close family, we don't like hang out, we're not like spending Christmases together, you know, we each had a little bit of information, but nobody had the full picture as to what was going on. So at this point, we kind of all joined forces and are like, what is going on? So my brother calls Julie on the 28th of April after my uncle, his wife, and my cousin were denied access to my dad, and said that, you know, even though he had scheduled this with my father to see him, that Ken didn't want to see him. He didn't want to see him. So that changed. There was no real explanation. They weren't exactly lovey in their response to people. They were, what in narcissistic terms we would call flying monkeys. They were doing, whether they were doing it on the behalf of my father or, just to keep people away from him so they could do what they needed to do, I don't know. So at that point, brother reaches out to Julie and has a conversation, and we are very concerned at this point. And so, you know, there's texts back and forth, and I haven't looked at their texts. It's just too triggering, where, you know, they're reaching out to me and, you know, your dad doesn't want to see you guys. And, you know, it's his wishes. And then she tells, my brother on the phone, well, Kevin, that's her husband, is going to reach out to your sister in the morning. So this is the evening of the 28th of April, 2 days before my dad died. On the 29th in the morning, Kevin calls first thing, and I'm ready, right? At this point, I'm very concerned. And he says to me, it's imminent. Your dad's going to die any moment. He didn't want to see you guys, but I think it would be a good idea if you came out to see him. We're going to let you guys see him. So I'm like, what do you mean imminent? What happened? Like, how did this happen? Like, you know, I wasn't supposed to come out now. Like, I didn't know he didn't want to see us. In fact, the only conversations I ever had with my father is that he did want us to be there. And that's all I'd ever heard. So, and of course, none of this is coming from my father. We've just been so overwhelmed, he said, with phone calls and texts. We had to turn the phone off, right? He said that. Yikes. So he's like, you need to hurry. You need to get here quick. And so I book a plane, left Kansas City at like 4, got into Pennsylvania at 12:30. And when I landed, I left out something. I called my brother and sister and I said, it's imminent. It's imminent. I'm flying in. And so my brother says, you know, I'm booking a flight too. I'm coming in. And my brother just broke down. I mean, he just broke down on the phone. And I said, look, we got to get it together. And like, you know, we got to be calm. Like, you know, these people are not wanting to let us see him. I can tell. But I think at this point they were doing some damage control and we're concerned what would happen if they didn't let us see him. So when my plane lands in Harrisburg, there's texts, you know, you get off the plane and, you know, you're off airplane mode and all of a sudden there's all these texts and my sister's meeting me there and picking up a rental car. And it was a long night. I was so tired. And at the same time, my mother-in-law is now also on hospice and she only has days to live. So my husband's dealing with that and I'm dealing with this. And so there's all these texts and one was like, don't come. And then the other one said, no, do come from him and hurry. And so I, you know, I'm like looking at my phone and my sister's and, you know, just getting dropped off by her friend. And so I text Kevin and I say, we're coming. Like, we're coming right now. My niece was there and my sister. This is, you know, 12:30 in the morning. And so we get in the rental car and Aaron's like, we're going right now. And I said, yeah, we have to go right now. And I told Kevin we would text him when we got there. And so, I have not been able to get a hold of my brother all day. So there was one phone call where he broke down and said he was going to come out. And then I tried calling him numerous times and could never get a hold of him, right? So I didn't know what was going on there. I was talking to my mom a little bit as well. And she's like, well, he just doesn't want to talk. And, you know, because he lives with my mom. And so down in Arkansas, I'm in Kansas City. My sister's in Pennsylvania. So we make this 45-minute drive from the Harrisburg airport to New Bloomfield at night, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. And we're just, I mean, the air was just thick with this anticipation of what we were about to experience and what was going to happen and, you know, what he was going to say to us and what we were going to say to him. And, you know, I was just so happy that we'd made it in time to talk to him and to say our goodbyes and to tell him, you know, we're here, we love you. We wanted him to go in peace, right? Regardless of all the fresh hell he brought to our lives, at the end of the day, he was our dad and we loved him. So we make this drive up into, you know, Perry County, New Bloomfield, Pennsylvania, and it's pretty. It's like, you know, you can't really see it at night, but windy roads and hills and I had been there, of course, once before. I mean, I didn't know the way, but I was at least familiar enough. I'd know when we were there because it's kind of a hidden driveway. So we get there and it's maybe 2:30 in the morning, 2 o'clock. And I text Kevin, he meets us out in the driveway. And, you know, he's kind of a foreboding figure, right? He's very like, he looks like law enforcement, right? Of course, we don't think he was law enforcement, but, and that was one thing he had said that ended up not being true. And so meets us out in the driveway and says, you know, Julie's asleep, but, you know, come on in and we'll go down. Here's how we're going to do this. Right. And he's kind of like, you know, rubbing our backs and talking in hushed tones. And, you know, this just like, oh, I'm so concerned about you guys kind of thing. And, he's like, you know, we don't want to wake him. He's sleeping. And of course I'm thinking, wait, what? He's dying. Like, this is it. Right. You said imminent, hurry. We're here. We're not going to get to talk to him. He's like, I'm going to take you down one at a time. And don't say anything and just stand, you know, kind of off the side of the bed. And then, you know, when he wakes up, then you can come back and talk to him. Of course, that never happened. So we go into their home, three women, and he did mention Mike had called. So my brother had called at some point, and that was in the text that Mike had called and upset my dad. You know, he called and they allowed my brother to talk to my dad and my dad had talked back. So there was conversation there. And
And, you know, Mike said, "I love you, Dad." And, you know, my dad said, "I love you, son." And, you know, the actual conversation, it was very short. They cut it off at some point. They took the phone back upstairs. So whether my dad wanted to say more, wanted to talk to him more, I don't know. I don't, but at that point it establishes that my father was able to speak. And there's conversations after that where they were basically saying he couldn't. So that doesn't make sense. And so my brother did get to talk to him that day, hours before his death. It's just something that my sister and I did not get to do. So Kevin takes my niece Jillian down and, you know, kind of has his hand on her back and holding her hand. And, you know, at the time you're just in shock. You're not really thinking, this guy's weird. This is creepy. You know, we should be able to talk to him. You know, and of course, at this point, he's also saying my brother's not allowed to physically come see him. And that if he does, he'll have his law enforcement buddies come up and take care of it. And he's got a gun, right? He's got his gun. And if he has to, you know. And I'm thinking, this is my brother you're talking about. And my uncle, because he said the same thing about my uncle, right? You know, basically males at this point, right? Any males that want to see my dad are not allowed. I guess he thought he could handle a couple of females if he had to. And so she goes down and comes back up and she's visibly upset. And my sister goes down next. Same thing, hand on the back, holding the hand, you know, hugging. It just, ugh. And she comes back up and she's like, he's just sleeping. You can see him breathing. And so I go down next and I was kind of at the corner where he wanted me. You could just feel like his presence right there, not my dad, Kevin's. And I see my dad and he's breathing. He's looked comfortable. His eyes are closed. And I just very quietly said, "I love you, Dad." And I paused and I kind of walked to the end of the bed, you know, right in front of him, which Kevin kind of almost like made a move, like to kind of pull me back. And I just stood there for a moment and looked at him. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, he's breathing right now. We can come back and talk to him in a few hours. So we go back upstairs. And, you know, Jillian and my sister are very upset and we're talking. And he's talking about the machines and, you know, what it's been like for them and, you know, how hard it is and how he didn't want a hospital bed. And he yelled out, "Dignity," like he couldn't say dignity, even though he just talked to my brother on the phone, right? And he really can't speak is what he said. I'm like, come to find out, we knew he had talked to him, but we didn't know that my dad had talked back, my brother. And so he's, you know, "Oh, we just have to lay there." And sometimes he throws himself off the bed and he's painting a picture. We realize now, right? He's selling a narrative. And I'm like, well, he's like, and he doesn't want a hospital bed. And so, and of course I'm thinking, I don't care what he wants, right? I mean, he should have a hospital bed. It's a bed. It would be more comfortable for him. It'd be safer for him. And so we're up there talking for a few minutes and he'd be like, "I can hear him from up here." So, you know, and he'd kind of walk closer to the stairs to the basement, occasionally kind of come back. And one point he kind of goes over there and looks down the stairs. He's like, "I'll be right back." My sister had gone outside for a moment. And so it's just me and my niece in the house. And maybe about a minute later, so more than just a quick trip to the basement, right? A minute seems very short, but reality, a minute is longer than this should have been. And next thing I know, he's screaming, he's running up the steps and he's screaming, "Lauren, Lauren, come with me, come with me." And so I follow him into the basement. At this point, my sister's coming in the house and she sees me running towards the stairs. And so she's running right behind me with my niece in tow. And my niece is 21, by the way. She's, you know, she was almost 21 at the time she was 20. And my dad, we get down to the basement bedroom and he's not in the bed. And And so I go to the other side of the bed. Because he, I don't know what happened. Okay, so I'm not going to say fell. He's on the other side of the bed on the floor. And he's laying on his right side. He fell from the left side of the bed, but he's laying on his right side. And his eyes are open. And there's blood on the right side of his face. And Kevin's yelling, put the oxygen mask back on. Turn the oxygen tank up. Well, the oxygen tank seemed to be off to me. And his mask was definitely, you know, not on his face. And so I put that on. And Kevin's like, DNR, DNR. But he was kind of shaking him. And my dad's eyes were open. And I was holding his hand. My sister was screaming. I mean, just, Dad, Dad, and sobbing. And he had this blood on his face. And I just thought, what happened? And there's this table, you know, if he's laying in bed to his left, to my father's left, had like a cup of water. There was a picture frames, a couple of papers, and his cell phone. And they were now all on the floor. The cup was upright. And I'm like, he has blood on his face. What, you know, and he's like, well, we must have hit that picture frame, which I thought that was odd. And he just kind of thought that right off the bat, right? Like he didn't seem to want to know why he had this injury to his face. And I thought he squeezed my hand at one point. And his blue eyes were kind of this yellow color. And he was just, because I was on my dad's right side. And so he was facing me. And I just remember telling my sister, he's gone, sweetie. He's gone. And so, you know, we cried and we sat there. And I held my dad's hand for almost 2 hours. And I really didn't want to hold that often when he was alive. But that I felt like I had to when he passed, because I didn't want him to be alone. And Aaron went and woke Julie up, and which I think is very odd, because surely she could hear my sister screaming. We joke now that it's probably because she thought Kevin was killing us and he wasn't done yet. So I really think we were in some danger that night, looking back at it. But we sat there, and about an hour later, the hospice nurse came and declared him dead. And she asked this question, and I just absolutely regret that we didn't speak up. She said, do you want an autopsy? And I just remember Kevin saying, no, no, I don't think that's necessary. And you just don't feel like you have a voice in this moment. First of all, you're in complete shock what you just went through. You're in a stranger's home, somebody who's talked about their guns and they're, you know, kicking your brother and uncle off the property. And if they had to, they'd use a gun and cameras on their property and all this stuff. And, you know, and your dad just died. And, you know, we texted a few people. And I grabbed my dad's phone at one point. It was on the floor, and I put it on the bed. And not 5 seconds later, that phone disappeared. And I wish I would have just put it in my pocket now, but so we sat there, and the hospice nurse came, and she declared him dead, and the funeral home showed up about an hour later, and cracking jokes, and, you know, oh, the people never die between 8 and 5, and we're in this basement, right? They're going to bring this gurney down, and, you know, Kevin's, you know, just standing there. I didn't see Julie cry. I think Kevin had some tears. Maybe. I don't really remember that much about how they were interacting with each other. You know, they got us coffee. Here, take your dad's rings. You know, oh, here's some, you know, Christmas ornaments, I think, that, you know, I got from your dad's house that maybe you should stay in the family. And I'm like, out of all the things in my dad's house, this is the one thing, right? I was just there. This is really, you're doing this right now. She even leaned across my dad's body and kind of patted me on the leg and said, I got your mom in the will. I got your mom in the will. I remember being like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, they were just weird. It was weird. And only real tears I saw came when their daughter came downstairs. And now that I think about it, you know, they have a 13-year-old daughter. Kevin has numerous children from other marriages, but, or relationships that we've since come to find out about. But yeah, her daughter was crying. And we know people who know them. So we know things about them they probably don't want us to know. And things that Sammy, that's the daughter, said to her friends at school. So we know a lot more now than we knew that night, right? Or morning, I guess. And so she came down and then they're just getting her ready for school to take her to school. And I'm like, she's going to school? Okay. Because she looked pretty traumatized, honestly. And but you know, Julie's making coffee, and I remember the hospice nurse saying to Julie, I'm so sorry for your loss. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You fucking have to be kidding me. Like, we're his kids. This is his granddaughter, right? And so they played this kind of like, oh, you poor girls. And the funeral home comes again, cracking jokes. And they have this gurney and they're like, well, what's the best way to do this, you know? And Kevin's like, probably going up these steps out of the basement, which are very steep. And he's like, I can't. So he leaves because it's these two older guys. And they're like, oh, we're probably going to need some help. And Kevin's like, no, I can't. And so he leaves the room. And they put my dad in the body bag. And so we're carrying my father's body up the stairs, me and my sister. Oh, my strong girls. The guy from the funeral home says, you strong girls. Look at my strong girls. And I'm just like, this is not happening. And so now we're in the driveway. And we went back downstairs, and you know, Aaron had taken a few pictures, not of the whole room, which I regret, but of my father in that specific area. And you know, we had our box of ornaments and my dad's rings. You know, they're not like valuable, sentimental, yes, to us. They're valuable, but it's not like they could pawned them and made money off of them. And that's it. No, hey, you guys should have these pictures, or here's this that your dad had, or, you know. So we're standing up in the driveway, and Julie says, you know, the funeral home says, hey, can we do 3 o'clock today? And I'm like, yeah, I think we can do 3. And, you know, he's like, I need a family member to fill some stuff out. And, you know, well, Kevin's like, well, I'll be there too, you know. So we're going to meet at 3 o'clock at the funeral home. We're standing there, and Julie's like, we should have you guys over, and we can just, you know, you're family now, and you know, blah, 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 the sentimental whatever. Just a bunch of BS. It was just a bunch of BS. They couldn't wait for us to get off their property, I assure you. And so we're in the driveway, and like, we'll have a bonfire, and we'll take you up to the mountain and show you where your dad wants his ashes spread. And I'm like, what? Okay, great. And yeah, we were not going on top of a mountain with them. Probably be the last thing we did. And so we left, the three of us. Well, my niece left with her friend who had come to pick her up because she just felt sick. And my sister and I left. And, you know, we were just in complete shock. So my uncle Barry had tried calling us a couple of times. And we talked to him finally, and you know, he's like, you know, we need to have a long conversation, you know, before you go to the funeral home. We've hired attorneys to look into some things. We're concerned. We need to find out about the will. You know, we think that they've taken money from your dad's accounts. And yeah, I'm not going to go into how they knew that, but they knew that. And they had some help. This is what we're hearing on our way, you know, back to Lemoyne, you know, after my dad just died. And we're just like, I haven't slept, right? I've had no sleep. My sister also has had no sleep. And we're just spent and sad and confused about what's happening. And we never got to talk to him.
And then in the, you know, coming days, that just got more complicated. That day, the funeral home, things kind of went south, and I think I'll pick up there in our next episode. But that's what happened that night. Certainly a lot of concern over it, but there's a lot to unpack before and after it as well. And I also think it is really important to kind of tell the story of my father and his upbringing. You know, it's a little bit of self-help, right? Narcissistic father, you know, and how that played into who we are and how we're coping and what it's like to have somebody like that in your life, and what it does to you. But it's also what it did to him at the end. You know, he met his match, so to speak. You know, there are people that took advantage of his need for ego strokes and, you know, always agreeing with him. And they certainly did that. And we have some evidence to that. So there was some mind manipulation going on and lies being told about who they were. Because if my dad knew who they really were, he probably never would have given them the time of day. And then, you know, we have a private investigator now. So looking into some of the things we found just from doing some of our own searching, it's been very concerning, trying to get law enforcement to listen. So go into more of that in the next episode, but this one's pretty long, so I think I'll sign off. I'm tired. I have some work to do, but good night. Thank you for listening. Sorry about some cuss words. It's just gonna happen. It's just who I am. All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye. Okay, this is episode 3 of On Irish Road. I have been on a trip with my family into the Mighty 5 in Utah. It was gorgeous, but very hot. But it was fun. And I took my dad with me in my purse, which, by the way, is not very big. Normally I have quite large purses, and so there'd be ample room. But I did kind of pick and choose what was coming with me, and he made the cut. So, yeah, bully for you, Dad. In his pill bottle. Which sounds horrible and cold. I get that. I get that that just sounds like a, you know, not a nice thing. But it's a process. Just a process. Trying to figure all of this out. And I wanted that watershed moment. That moment where I was in, you know, a beautiful place. And the words just came to me. And the moment was just surreal. And it was the perfect place, and, you know, I would feel like I was doing right by him and right by me, and it would be cathartic, and I could kind of move on, and, yeah, so that didn't happen. I think part of it's because I just didn't feel like he really would have wanted to be any of those places, and he's still my dad, and it just wasn't right. So he, you know, came with me in my purse, and then when we would go on hikes, he'd go in the backpack. And first of all, in national parks, you have to have a permit, and it's only like certain places. So I knew it was going to have to be outside the park system, and I just never found the right spot. It never felt right, so I didn't do it. So my dad is now out of my purse, and he is sitting on my dresser. I'm looking at him right now. I mean, I'm looking at his room. Cremains, his cremains. No, it's not my father. I'm not that far removed from reality. But so I think the first part of these is going to be, number one, I don't even think anybody's listening, so I don't think it matters. And number two, I'm feeling a little sorry for myself. I think everything's kind of quieted down. And, you know, I know these things don't, you know, move like rapid fire, but surely they move quicker than this. And I have yet to hear back from the private investigator. But again, I have been out of town and not a lot of cell service. So that's on my agenda this week. And sometimes those small tasks feel like the biggest ones because you're not sure what to anticipate, what information you're going to get or not get. I think that's also scary, right? The thought that maybe all of this was just odd, wild coincidences and things that looked bad. But then I remember the night that he died and the events immediately after. And I think, no, there's something there. Like I said, there. There's definitely, you know, the other part of it is people go away, like that were there to support you. And we didn't have a big support group, you know, my dad's side of the family. I think they knew my dad was full of shit and they didn't trust him for sure, but they definitely, there was no interaction with us. I mean, that was by design for my dad, but they were adults. I mean, you know, nobody really talked to us. And then just for a little bit right after he died, but and that goes away as well. Everybody has their own life and agenda, and nobody really wants to hear the sad story of the McClay kids and how abusive their father was. And I don't know, maybe they don't care. Maybe they just don't understand. Maybe it's too painful. I don't know. I'm going to give them some grace. I think they're good people. So, you know, our lives were not intertwined. And so I can't blame them. I also think, you know, he said some pretty reprehensible things about his children. I'm sure there's some belief there that some of those things are true. And I don't have any reason to try to or want to undo the lies that my dad said about us. It's just not, it's a waste of time. You know, we are best served to live our best life. But the saddest part is I haven't heard from my siblings. And I think that is also very painful. You know, we had shared experiences through pain, trauma bonding, and, but we didn't spend all that much time together. And when we did, we were just such different ages, experiencing different things, and all played different roles with both of our parents. Because, you know, I have a father, but I also have a mother. And so when she's still alive, and we'll talk about her at some point, but she's not a narcissist, thank God. And, but yeah, they've kind of, you know, I'm kind of the person that calls and reaches out. And then, you know, my mom would say, oh, you need to reach out to your brother. You need to talk to your brother. He really needs you. And then I would, and we'd talk. And then when I needed him, you know, nobody calls back. There's no return calls. There's no return texts. And at some point you just have to say, okay, I mean, we share the same bloodline, right? And the same parents. And we shared a lot of bad experiences, a few good ones. That's why I think I pushed so hard for like going on a family trip after he died, was because we could start to create new memories. So I'm having a pity party myself right now, which is probably pretty obvious. I'm feeling very alone, which is why I'm talking into my phone. Because that just makes all the sense in the world, right? It doesn't, absolutely does not, but it's somewhat cathartic to just have it out there. Because the thought of going through it all alone is devastating. My husband listens, but he, you know, he's been with me for 23 years. He's heard it, he knows, and I'm aware that I'm being redundant and I'm saying the same things in different ways, and it's just too painful. It's why it was so nice to get away for 10 days and just not, you know, not be focused on that, but be focused on my kids and you know, the beauty that we were in and the experiences that we had and making their world right. And because that's your job as a parent, right? No matter what's going on, is to make your children's world beautiful and good and to teach them the things and how to get through the pain and what pain does for you. It's powerful. It's perspective. It's, you know, it's empathy. It's all of those things. And so I'm grateful for that. But I'm feeling a little lost, you know, because I'm waiting for that moment where I'm moving on. You know, people say, forgive, you have to forgive, forgive. Well, first of all, I don't even know where to start. Like, who do I start? Just forgive everybody blindly? Because I'm not feeling it. Like, I'm just not feeling it. I'm not feeling like I want to forgive my dad. I don't think I ever really did. I don't really feel like I just am not going to do that right now. I don't feel like it's even in me. I'm definitely not going to forgive Sundays for hijacking the end of my dad's life and our mourning and, you know, that immediate aftermath and what they've done. I'm just not there. I'm angry, right? I think I've just been kind of stuck in this angry, frustrated place. And anyway, so I think it's more about remembering and resolve to move forward. And at some point, that's going to just have to happen. And maybe I'll just pick at it here and there, but I have to at least get their story out there. My parents' story, my dad's story, my siblings' story, and the rest of what happened to the Sundays, you know, regarding my father's death. And up until, I guess, there's no more news and no more information, and I can say we did what we could, but, you know, I just don't want them to do this to somebody else. So I left off with my sister and myself driving away from their home on Irish Road, and we had an appointment for 3:00 in New Bloomfield at the funeral home. So, you know, my dad lived in Camp Hill, like Lemoyne, Pennsylvania, which is outside of Harrisburg. And he had relationships with multiple people that he saw on a regular basis, neighbors. You know, for a long time, his dentist was his executor. I mean, for years and years, my dad would tell me, you know, this, his name was Andy, and that he would be contacting you, and that he was a good guy, and they had this great relationship. And for years, ever since my dad moved into that place, you know, he struck up a friendship with a lot of times with medical professionals. These were the people that, you know, would listen to my dad. My dad, again, narcissist. They like to talk about themselves. They like to, you know, and he did. And, you know, and to some people that felt very, because there were boundaries, right? Like, you know, that was a real relationship that they had. And I'm sure that Andy felt that way. Probably felt very betrayed at the end, as I think not just him, but some other people did, by my dad's actions or, you know, lack of communication about what was going on. But he, you know, had this relationship with people in that area. And so the fact that he was moved from a pretty populated area, where, you know, his daughter lived close by, his brothers lived close by, out to, you know, about 45 minutes away, kind of out in the boonies. It's beautiful for sure, but it's definitely removed. And, you know, all of these contacts were made by the Sundays. I mean, they arranged for these people, the funeral home, the attorney, you know, the witnesses, the notary, were all people that they themselves lined up. And not people we were aware of. I don't even think my dad knew them. And maybe he met them once at the end. But so we have this 3:00 appointment at Boyer Funeral Home in New Bloomfield, Pennsylvania. Remember, we've just left New Bloomfield and headed back to my sister's house. And I had a hotel room because I thought I was going to see my dad in his final days. I didn't think I was going to witness my father's death.
And so we got back to my sister's house, and my Uncle Barry had said, you know, big concerns here, and we've hired an attorney, and, you know, they gave us some information about how they knew that some money had been taken out, and they were very concerned, and they said, you know, when you go, so this is like 7 o'clock in the morning at this point, right? Haven't slept, traumatized, shocked. People are calling, texting, wanting to know what's going on, and I just wanted a shower and a cup of coffee. And we're sitting on my sister's front porch smoking cigarettes, which I have not done since I was a bartender back in, oh my gosh, I mean, like 1996, I think. And so we're sitting on her front porch in total shock, talking to people, and my Uncle Barry says on the phone, need you to find out about the will. I need you to find out, you know, anything that you can about what's in the will. I need you to get a copy of the death certificate. I go back to the hotel. I'm like, I have to go back. I have to shower. I have to change. Get to my sister's house back again. It's, you know, about 20 minutes away from my hotel. I had no idea where she lived, so when I booked it, I didn't realize. And meet back there. And we head up there, and we get lost. We're just tired, not sleeping, exhausted, haven't eaten, driving to back to New Bloomfield to meet Kevin. And the funeral home director. So we get there and we're about 30 minutes late. I think Garen texted a couple times and said, we're on our way. We just got lost. And we walk in, and I'm not kidding you, the first words out of Kevin's mouth. He's sitting there with this redheaded woman, you know, not real red hair, just like really red hair, and all done up in a bun and glasses, kind of like the sexy librarian, except not really that sexy, maybe to some people. And he's like, well, I didn't know if you guys were going to make it. This is what he says to the children, right, of the man who just passed away in his basement. And, of course, I think I said something like, well, everything's 45 minutes away from where we are, Kevin. So at this point, I'm angry, right? There's that rage inside of me. Something's wrong. We've known it. It's kind of been confirmed at this point. And so we're in there, and they start asking questions about my dad. And my sister answered most of them. Kevin would try. But one of the things he had brought up before when we were talking, and I hadn't said anything before my father passed, was, well, you know, your dad and I bonded over being in law enforcement. You know, your dad in the FBI, I mean, the DOJ, CIA, right? So this is what he's saying. And I'm like, okay. Dad was never in the FBI. I didn't say that, but I'm thinking, what? What are you talking about? And so one of the things they want to know is what my dad's occupation was. And so Kevin says, well, he's retired FBI. And I said, nope. And he's like, well, DOJ. I said, no, never was in law enforcement. Never was in law enforcement. He worked for Health and Human Services. He did kind of retire, actually took disability from the government so that his blood pressure was too high when he went into work, like, you know, every other person on the planet. And so he got his doctor. Remember, he liked to strike up these relationships with healthcare professionals. His name was Dr. Short or Small. I can't remember. I actually have that letter. And my dad got disability from the government. And really what it came down to is he had a female boss. And my dad was very, you know, very much a chauvinist. Really thought women's place was in the kitchen. They should all cook, take care of the kids. Man went out, got a job. Unless he met a woman that had a job, like as a nurse or a teacher. He really liked, like, it was like they were still doing the womanly thing. They were a nurse or a teacher. They were in that nurturing kind of thing, things men didn't do, you know. Then he liked those women. But anything outside of that was just not okay. So he had a female boss, when he worked at the federal building in downtown Kansas City, and he couldn't handle it. Long story short, I mean, he just couldn't handle it. He could not handle having women tell him what to do. And which, you know, speaks to me, because I wasn't really good at not telling people what to do. So I'm sure he did not like that part of me at all. And it probably plays back to his mom, which we'll get into at some point. But because there's a connection there with his mom that pulls Julie in, where he was calling Julie things that he should not have been. I mean, it was just manipulation, mind manipulation. So I said, no, he did work for the federal government. He got disability and then went and worked for my uncle and, you know, had basically double income at this point, but hid it from my mom. So my mom never got any extra money. So he left the kids and my mom behind, left me with a family that he didn't even really know. And they ended up being insane. And I ended up on my own after that because she accused me of sleeping with her husband, which I was 15, 16 maybe at the time. Timelines are difficult when you're just going through so much trauma. And so he looked genuinely shocked. He knew little to nothing about my dad, right? He knew what my dad told him. So you had a narcissist and a potential narcissist in Kevin. I'm not quite sure, but definitely somebody who was not on the up and up, right? They're just lying to each other, just lying to each other, going back and forth, creating just this fake world that didn't exist. And then the people who are being honest and truthful, the children, get caught in the middle of all of this, and we're just in the crosshairs. And so, I'll pick out whatever you want, girls. I remember saying that, just whatever you want. Well, you know, we're like, okay, well, I guess we'll get like this necklace. You know, this is all weird. And he's like, oh, and a flag. And we'll just need the DD-14 or DD-214 or something. And, oh yeah, I'm sure I have it back at the house. And so, you know, he's just kind of guiding this whole conversation. And we're just kind of talking. I'm like, well, what about my brother? Like, we need something for my brother. And he's like, oh, well, remember, he didn't want my brother to even come see my father. In fact, basically threatened, you know, brutal force if he showed up. He had cameras at the end of his driveway, and he'd get his military buddies or his law enforcement buddies, I don't remember which one he said, you know, to come remove anybody from the property that wasn't supposed to be there. And he seemed completely put out by the fact that my brother was being included in this conversation. And Aaron and I are just sitting there in complete shock. These two clearly knew each other. Her name was Kelly, is Kelly. She's still on the planet, I'm assuming, and Kevin. And it would not surprise me if there was something going on there. So anyway, we go through everything. We asked for death certificates, and he looked at me, he's like, well, why would you need that? And I was like, well, we'd like to have a couple. And he very hesitantly said, fine. And he added it to the order, right? And he's acting like he's paying for it, when, right, it's my dad. My dad, the state, is paying for all this. And comes time to talk about the cremains. And he's like, you know, yeah, so I'm going to, you know, they go to me. You know, Ken wanted to be buried on, want me to spread his ashes on top of this mountain, which we had heard. So this is legitimate. This isn't something he was making up. This is something my father had actually said. It's just kind of heartbreaking. And I remember saying to my dad, are you sure that's where you want to, like, where are we going to go visit you? Where's, he's like, well, I mean, and my dad just didn't want to talk about stuff. I think he didn't understand that we cared, right? I think he thought, because we didn't bow down and stroke his ego and go along with everything that he said, that we were just these heartless, you know, kids who didn't care about their dad. He didn't understand. To him, caring would have been anything he wanted, whenever he wanted, us being who he wanted, even though we had no idea what that was. And so, you know, I said, well, I'd like some of my dad's cremains, of course, because that's what they use as cremains, which I hate that word for whatever reason. And she said, okay, well, I can give you each a little pill bottle. And she kind of looked at Kevin. I'm like, why is this guy, who I don't know, who's the executor, apparently not this point, because it hasn't gone through the court, right? So we're still thinking
he has some power here, and he really didn't. It really should have been us. Because, you know, there's a lull, right? As soon as my dad died, power of attorney ended. We're not even sure if he had power of attorney. But, you know, the executor doesn't kick in until days after. So we should have had access to the whole, you know, burial process, the whole, you know, all of that should have been on us to do, not on Kevin. And it's like he was just hijacking the whole process. The things that would have taken us through this were, he just jumped in the boat and started rowing, and we were really just in complete shock. Of course, we also have in the back of our heads that something's amiss, and that what happened that night was odd, which was just hours earlier, and then what my uncles are now saying. So we leave the funeral home. We're standing outside, and of course now I have this, you know, agenda to find out about the will. And so he's like, yeah, he starts in with, you know, Julie, his wife, it was the caretaker, whatever, is, you know, she wants to have you guys up for a barbecue. I don't know if it's going to happen today. You know, we'll just see. She's just really tired and not feeling that great. And she's been a lot for us. It's really, we're really sad. And just really hard going down into the basement. Your dad's not there. And, you know, and he's saying all this stuff. And you're just like, yeah, I mean, he was my dad, right? He was in my life for 47 years, but you knew him for what, 1.5? So yeah, totally get why you would be having a harder time with this than me. And so I said, hey, you know, I need to know about the will, like what's up with the will. And he said, well, what do you mean? His demeanor definitely changed. And my sister, because we had talked about this, I'd said, you know, when I bring this up, just mention mom, because my mom's completely unassuming. You know, probably was never mentioned by my dad. And I only know she's in the will because Julie reached across my dad's father and patted me on the leg and said, I got your mom in the will, right? So this is the kind of BS we're dealing with. And my sister says, well, mom wants to know. And he's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, I mean, you know, your dad didn't want you guys to see the will. He didn't want anybody to see the well except for me and the attorney. So, you know, I can't give you a copy of it, but you guys each get X amount of dollars, which I will just tell you is not very much. And, you know, each of your kids gets between 10 to 20,000. Your dad didn't have as much money as everybody thought. And he was really concerned about his brothers getting their hands on his money. And he just didn't have that much. He didn't have, and I don't get anything. I'm not in the will at all. I'm not getting anything. We're not getting anything. We didn't benefit from this at all. So he's like now going on this diatribe about how my dad didn't want us to see the will, that, you know, those were his wishes, and that he's just trying to carry out his good friend Ken's wishes. Of course, again, this is my father he's talking about. How my dad didn't have any money and how my uncles wanted my dad's money. Well, first of all, one of my uncles is loaded. There's absolutely no way he could give two craps. That's just pocket change to him, right? And he doesn't care. And the other one, you know, is like religious and, you know, is doing something with orphanages and stuff. I mean, there's just, this doesn't even make any sense, right? There's no play for money there. And it's a no contest state, right? So also in the back of my head, I'm thinking, if we're in the will, we get a copy of the will. So why are you saying this? Like, it doesn't even make sense. And then my sister says, well, what about, you know, our dad's stuff, like, you know, all of his things, pictures. And he's like, we didn't have that many pictures. Well, I was there in December and I saw he did have quite a few pictures. He had a lot of stuff. I mean, I was just there 4 months prior, right? 5 months prior. So, before, like 4 months prior. And, he's like, well, you know, there's some watches and some Hummels and the Biersteins, because my sister had mentioned some of this stuff. And he's like, I could probably, you know, we could probably break some of that stuff out and you guys could pick some stuff, you know, out. So he has the stuff at his house, right? He says the Biersteins are in my dad's home. That's apparently going on the market, but they've been emptying it out. So they've been emptying the house out with my dad in their possession when he was alive, going over there without any oversight and emptying it out. And we find out some other things we didn't know about from a woman who used to clean the house later on, Sheila, and I will bring that up at some point. But, so, I mean, there's not even the chance to like sit and go through pictures or look at his things or pick out a shirt or, you know, like none of this is happening. It's like we've just been completely cut off from my dad's life and our right as his children to just like sit on the floor where my dad lived for all those years and where we spent time as well. And they just took it all away. And he was being a little aggressive and lying, right? Because at this point, we had a general idea of how much money my dad had. He said something about charities. And that was something my dad had mentioned. So we had an idea that my dad was... We'd gotten two different stories, right? That he was going to leave us everything except some was going to go to charity. And then he had mentioned... you know, that he wasn't sure what he was going to do. He wanted to leave some to charity, but we had always been a big part of the will. He'd always talked about, you know, what he was going to do. At this point, I'm like, whatever has been done. Like, there's no changing that, but I want to make sure that they don't get anything, right? And we need to see a copy of this will because we know that it had changed recently. We didn't realize how recent until the attorneys told us that the will had been changed 8 days before my dad died. And remember, they are also selling this narrative, Julie and Kevin, that my dad couldn't talk. He was having a hard time. He could just say things like dignity. And, but then my brother says, no, I talked to him the night he died and he was talking. So could he talk or couldn't he? I mean, it was like we were going back and forth, right? So anyway, we leave. And I look in my rearview mirror and we're driving on these windy roads. And, you know, the way we left, it basically, he like comes in for a hug. And I'm just like, in fact, he hugged me and I was facing my sister. I rolled my eyes. I don't like to hug anybody, really. I did not want to hug this man. He had been so handsy with all of us. It was just really disturbing. And so I get in my car and... we're driving on these windy roads and I look at my rearview mirror and he's got this big Dodge Ram 350, right? It has like hundreds of thousands of miles on it from his job. Okay. Which he said, by the way, when we were talking about what we did in the funeral home, each of us individually, he said he was in banking and finance, which is not what my dad said he was. He also, my dad also said, oh, Kevin makes $195,000 a year. Well, no, he definitely did not make that much money. I don't know if my dad was making that up or if Kevin was making that up. I think that's part of the problem here is we can't tell who's lying about what. We know they both lied. We just don't know which part was Kevin and which part was my dad and or Julie. And so I look and I see this big truck and it's Kevin's and I'm like, God, I hope he doesn't run us off the road. And my sister goes, oh my God. It was just this weird moment. And I looked over at her and I said, I think he would have killed us if we tried to talk to our dad that night. Do you think the reason he didn't want men up there was because he needed control over that situation? Do you think he killed dad? And my sister said, yeah, I was just thinking that. And everybody we talked to had suspicions and concerns. That's what happened, that my dad woke up. My dad wanted to talk to us. He heard us, or he woke up and Kevin wasn't in the room and he thought he had a moment to try to get help or reach out to somebody. And Kevin heard him and stopped him from doing that. These are big accusations, right? It's just speculation. And it's concerning to us. We don't know what happened and what didn't happen, but that's what this is about. And so we leave the funeral home. And not long after, we get back to my sister's house to smoke multiple packs of cigarettes to try to digest and also to talk to other people because everybody wants to know what's going on, right? At this point, there's people that care, or at least they seem to care. You know, I don't know. I think everybody was there for the fun part, right? What they considered the fun, dramatic part. And then as it started to get a little bit more real, everybody was like, oh, well, okay, so we did what we could, but we're out now.
bye. Have fun figuring this all out on your own. We got back there and we were just sitting there, just again, just in complete shock. And my Uncle Barry says, you know, I know this woman that knows the Sundays. And we would like it if you would come over and meet with her. You know, can you be here at whatever time? I can't remember what time. And so we agree that we'll go over and we'll meet with her. And so we headed over. Actually, I think that it was the next day we were going to talk to her. So we did end up meeting with my uncle and having dinner that night, again, in complete shock. We get a text from Julie. Of course, we were supposed to have a barbecue bonfire, right? We're going to go through. And she's like, I'm not feeling well tonight. It's just too much. I'm so tired. It's just, can we do it tomorrow? Right? And so I'm like, okay, yeah, that's fine. And at this point, you know, we're getting more information from our uncles about money that was, you know, taken out. And we have a meeting with our attorneys on Monday. So this is now Friday. It's the actual day my dad died. It's that night, right? Because this happened at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Now it's like 6 o'clock. And so we know we have a meeting on Monday. And that now we're going to have this barbecue with them on Saturday or bonfire, whatever. But of course, we're getting a little nervous, right? And so we go out to dinner with my uncle and he's like, I want you to meet this woman tomorrow because we had another barbecue scheduled with my cousin, my uncle's son, that next day. So we're kind of contemplating. So Friday, the day my dad died, was very eventful and we were exhausted and overwhelmed and we went back and, you know, we slept because we hadn't done that in some time and we reviewed, we talked to my brother. My brother was going to fly in on Sunday morning or Sunday evening, I'm sorry. And we're just preparing ourselves for the next few days. And the weekend just got more interesting as we moved through it. So we'll pick up on Saturday morning and the events of Saturday because it turns a little dark Saturday and Sunday. Things start to get a little more contentious. And the Sundays did and said things that made us very uncomfortable. So we will pick up where I'm leaving off right now the next time. I hope you have a great week, day, evening, morning, whatever. And remember, if you are in a relationship, whether it's a parental relationship, child, you're the spouse of, or the girlfriend or boyfriend of, somebody that is making you feel like you have no control over your life, who's making decisions for you, who's being abusive towards you, who is gaslighting you, who is manipulating you, you don't have to deal with that. The effects long term, I assure you, are much more damaging than any short term effects from leaving that situation. And they will haunt you. No contact is definitely the best way to go. But if you can't do that, then remember to be a gray rock and don't respond. At some point they'll move on because they need fuel for their fire. They need to burn bright. And if you're not feeding those flames, then they will find somebody who is. And that is honestly the best thing that can happen. It may feel like abandonment, but it's not, because they never really had the capacity to love. And I think that's the one thing I've learned through all of this is he never had the ability to be a good dad. It was never about us. It feels like it. It feels like it. Like it, that's what we're trying to undo, right? But that he just didn't have it. It was always about him. He didn't see us for who we were. It was his darkness was just
It was just cast in everybody's eyes. It's all he could ever see. And that's true of any narcissist. So, anyway, I will talk to you next time. Thank you so much.